Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we take your source material, your dense stack of articles, histories, and geological surveys, and we carve out the unexpected story at the center of it all.
Today we're focusing on a single name that is, well, it's utterly inescapable across the South Pacific. Abel Tasman.
It really is. You just have to glance at a map of that part of the world, and his footprint is massive.
Exactly. We're talking about the entire Tasman Sea, the island state of Tasmania itself, and the dramatic Tasman Peninsula, all of them named after this one 17th century Dutch seafarer, Abel Jensoon Tasman.
And he's a man whose name defines these huge geographical features, yet the sources you've given us paint a picture of an explorer who, despite, you know, accidentally revealing two massive landmasses, ended his career having utterly disappointed his corporate sponsors. It's an incredible dichotomy.
It is. Geographical immortality paired with commercial failure.
So that's our mission today, for you, our listener.
Right. We're going to unpack the intense commercial context of his voyages in the 1600s. And these weren't for a king or a queen. They were for the Dutch East India Company, the VOC.
Which was less a government agency and more like, what, the world's first truly global mega corporation.
That's a perfect way to put it. We need to understand their specific goals. Hunting for a phantom southern continent, finding lucrative new trade routes. Then we'll look at what he actually found, how his discoveries fundamentally changed maps forever, and why, at the time, his whole endeavor was considered a very expensive flop.
Okay, so let's start with the man himself. Who was Abel Tasman before he was a name on a map?
Well, he came from extremely humble origins. Born around 1602 or 1603 in a small village, Ledjegast, in the Netherlands. The sources suggest he had very little formal schooling.
So he wasn't one of those high-ranking naval officers with, you know, rigorous mathematical and astronomical training.
Not at all. He started out as a common merchant seaman. His entire education was practical, learned on the job, under some of the most intense and dangerous conditions imaginable.
But that practical skill clearly got him noticed.
It did. It propelled him. By 1633, he was able to join the VOC, and he sailed straight to the center of their Asian operations, a place called Batavia.
Which is now modern-day Jakarta in Indonesia.
Exactly. And moving to the Dutch East Indies was a huge career move. It put him right at the sharp end of global commerce and, frankly, global conflict.
And you can see his natural skill almost immediately. Within just a year of joining the VOC, by 1634, he was already promoted to skipper of his own ship, the Mocha.
But his career in the Indies was, well, it was far from peaceful. The VOC was engaged in what you could only call a brutal commercial war across the entire archipelago.
All focused on maintaining their spice monopoly.
A rigid, violent monopoly. And the sources mention this one incident that I think really shows the rough, high-stakes nature of the job.
Right. This is where he gets a real taste of the conflict. He was on a voyage to Seram Island, one of the key spice islands.
And he docked, supposedly, to gather wood and make repairs. But the background tension, you know, the real reason for the friction, was that the local villagers were selling valuable spices to competing European powers. They were bypassing the VOC.
Which to the VOC was an existential threat.
Absolutely. So during this stop, a fight broke out. The sources describe it as a violent exchange, and it resulted in the deaths of at least two of Tasman's men.
So it's vital to understand he wasn't just some peaceful cartographer. He was a corporate enforcer.
He was, operating in a territory where the lines between trade, exploration, and outright war were constantly blurred.
Okay, so by 1642, his reputation as this highly effective, if maybe ruthless, navigator is cemented.
And that deep, demonstrated experience is what gets him the big commission. The Council of the Indies in Batavia, headed by his patron, Governor General Antonio Van Diemen, they dispatched Tasman on an expedition of really immense scope.
Him and his chief pilot, a cartographer named Francois S. Jacob Zoon Visscher.
Yes, and the scope was global, but the objective was explicitly commercial. The council was obsessed with finding what they called the provinces of beach.
And this wasn't just some small island. This was a phantom landmass that had been appearing on European maps for centuries.
Right, stemming from these early mistranslated editions of Marco Polo's travel accounts. the rumor, you know, the one repeated endlessly by cartographers and hopeful investors.
Was that beach was a land of plentiful gold?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Think about the pressure on the VOC. They needed a new source of wealth, and this mythical continent was their great geographical lottery ticket.
So the mandate was clear.
Very clear. Three objectives. Explore all uncharted areas east of the Cape of Good Hope, south of the Solomon Islands, and west of this theoretical land near Cape Horn. And they were told explicitly, find this southern continent, Terra Australis Incognita, and find a new shipping route.
A way to link their Pacific trading areas or even just get around the massive landmass of New Holland, which is what they called Australia.
And for this monumental, almost mythological quest, what does he get?
Two small ships, the Heemskirk, a slow sort of flyboat, and the smaller, faster Zeehan, or Seagull.
It just highlights the risk, doesn't it? Small vessels, a massive mission, and the promise of either untold wealth or total ruin.
So, armed with this ghost of a golden land and a pair of sturdy, but let's face it, small ships, Tasman set sail from Batavia in August 1642.
And the logistical strategy for that first leg of the journey is actually quite revealing.
It tells you how much planning went into just surviving these voyages.
It was crucial. He didn't just head straight for the unknown. He sailed first across the Indian Ocean to the established VOC outpost of Mauritius, arriving on September 5th.
And this stop wasn't for a bit of rest and relaxation?
Not at all. It was strategic. The governor there, Adrian van der Stel, made sure they could properly reprovision, get fresh water, and use the excellent timber on the island to make critical repairs to the ships.
Before plunging into the unknown, violent oceans further east?
Exactly. And once they left Mauritius, the real engine of the voyage took over. The Southern Ocean currents and winds.
What we now know as the Roaring Forties.
Right. This is a band of incredibly powerful, persistent westerly winds that circle the globe down in the latitudes between 40 and 50 degrees south.
And if you could harness those winds,
you could cover immense distances incredibly quickly. Tasman sailed as far south as 49 degrees latitude to catch the strongest part of that wind stream and just blast eastward.
But the conditions must have been just brutal, pushing the limits of their ships and the crew's endurance.
The journals reflect this. By November 7th, the ship's council, that's Tasman, Vischer, and the other officers, they get together and make a decision.
They alter course slightly to the northeast, moving a little closer to the equator.
And the reason is clear in the sources.
Yeah.
They were encountering snow and hail.
Snow and hail, imagine that, in near what would eventually become the southern coast of Australia.
It's incredible. This extreme weather made the job of just maintaining the rigging and keeping the crew healthy almost impossible. They had to move north just to survive the elements, even if it cost them some speed.
And this powerful weather, it basically shoves them far further south and east than they'd anticipated.
Right into the history books. On November 24, 1642, the lookout sights land.
The west coast of Tasmania, specifically an area north of Macquarie Harbor. This is the first recorded European sighting of the island.
A major, completely unplanned discovery. And true to the hierarchical nature of the VOC, he doesn't name it after himself.
No, he names it after his highest patron, Governor General Antonio Van Diemen.
Calling it Van Diemen's Land. It was a political gesture as much as a geographical one, making sure his success was noted by the man who sent him.
So after the sighting, he sails south and eventually enters what he later named Storm Bay.
Which proved to be a very accurate description. The wind and the swell were ferocious. He tried to take shelter in what's now Adventure Bay, but was driven back out.
But
he was determined to claim the territory.
Meticulous about it.
Yes. On December 3rd, after anchoring near what he named Cape Frederick Hendrick, the sources detail the formal act of possession. The sea was too rough for a boat.
So what did they do?
A ship's carpenter had to swim through the heavy surf to get to the shore.
Oh.
He manages it, and he plants the Dutch flag, a small but powerful symbol, formally laying claim to this massive unknown island.
But this is where we see that crucial tension, the tension between the VOC's goals and the geographical reality.
Yes. The sources are clear on this. Tasman's primary directive was to find the southern continent, Terra Australis, which everyone assumed was one immense landmass. He was not looking for a string of smaller islands.
Yeah. So as he follows the east coast northward, he reaches a place called Eddystone Point. And the land there abruptly veers sharply to the northwest.
At the same time, his ships are getting battered by those relentless Roaring Forties winds, which are blowing unimpeded through the gap we now know as Bay Strait.
The channel separating Tasmania from mainland Australia.
It's a phenomenal moment of historical irony. The wind itself is screaming the message that this land is an island.
That it's separate from New Holland.
But Tasman is so focused on finding a continuous continental landmass that the moment the coastline turns, he ignores the hint. He abruptly changes course and turns east again to continue his continent hunting.
And that one decision was, well, it was fatal to Dutch interests in the region.
Absolutely. He literally sailed past the defining feature that would confirm the island status of the land he had just claimed. And that choice contributed heavily to the misconception that lasted for the next 125 years.
The idea that Van Diemen's Land was attached to the larger Australian landmass.
Or even the massive southern continent they were all looking for.
And that misconception was only reinforced by his very next big discovery, barely 2 weeks later.
Right. After sailing east into the open Pacific on December 13, 1642, the expedition sights the northwest coast of the South Island of New Zealand.
Again, the first European to ever reach it. And he names this new discovery Staten Land.
In honor of the States General, the Dutch Parliament. And again, the great misconception takes hold.
He believes, and he reports back, that this is the western mainland coast of the unknown Southland.
He was convinced he'd finally found it, the colossal continent that geographers had been dreaming of for centuries.
And that belief was so convincing, it stuck to European maps for more than a century. You see New Zealand rendered as this huge, vaguely sketched piece of coastline attached to a non-existent larger southern continent.
Until Captain Cook in 1769 actually sails all the way around the two islands and definitively disproves the theory.
But Tasman's first interaction with the local inhabitants in this new Staten Land was. It was immediate, and it was tragic.
It was. The expedition anchored near what is now Golden Bay, which Tasman originally named Zeehane's Bay.
And the sources give this really detailed, almost cinematic account of the first contact.
They do. They saw many lights on land, four vessels near the shore as evening fell. Then two canoes or waka paddled out towards them.
And the Maori people called out in what the Dutch described as gruff, hollow voices.
And they blew on an instrument that sounded to the sailors like Moore's trumpets. Tasman ordered his own trumpet player to play some tunes back, trying to signal peace.
But it didn't work.
No. The Maori did not approach closer than a stone's throw. They were wary, observant, and clearly assessing the threat. The tension was palpable overnight.
And the next morning, disaster struck before any real communication could happen.
Yes. As sailors were rowing the small ship's boat between the Heemskerk and the Zeehan, a group of Maori in a waka attacked suddenly.
It was swift. And it was brutal.
Four Dutch sailors were clubbed to death with traditional Maori patu, or clubs, before the Dutch ships could effectively respond. Tasman, profoundly shaken by this, he orders the anchor cut and they sail out of the bay as fast as they can.
And as they retreated, he observed 22 waka near the shore. He fired a cannon, hit a man in the largest canoe, which was curiously holding a small white flag.
And because of the four deaths, Tasman names the area Murderer's Bay.
Now, if we connect this to the sociological context the sources give us, the violence becomes a bit more understandable, if not less tragic. Why such an aggressive, preemptive attack?
The insight from archaeologists and historians like Ian Barber is compelling. The local Maori, likely the Nagari Tumarakushiri Iwi, may have been aggressively protecting a cultivation field.
Specifically, a valuable kumara, or sweet potato field.
Which was under intense ritual protection known as tapu.
And tapu is much more than just a simple prohibition, right?
Oh, much more. Tapu imposes a sacred status on a person, a place, an object, and it's accompanied by strict prohibitions. In this context, protecting a vital food source like kumara, especially since it was December, the midpoint of the growing season would have been paramount.
So any transgression against a tapu zone wasn't just an offense. It was a profound, dangerous breach of spiritual and communal law.
It was something capable of bringing disaster upon the entire tribe. So from the Maori perspective, the Dutch attempt to land, even if it's just for water, was an aggressive existential transgression against a religiously and culturally vital area.
It reframes the whole narrative of Murderer's Bay. It's a clash of two completely incompatible worldviews.
Exactly. And following this trauma, the expedition quickly retreated. They sailed north, sighted the narrow channel we now call Cook Strait, but they dismissed it.
Mistaking it for just a large bite, which Tasman named Zeehane's Bite.
The journey home did leave two lasting names in the far north of New Zealand, Cape Maria Van Diemen and the Three Kings Islands. But then they turned for home.
And it was a rough return voyage. They nearly wrecked on dangerous reefs while passing through the Fiji Islands.
Where the ships almost came apart. But Tasman skillfully charted the eastern tip of Vanuatu and Sikobia Ilau, proving his navigation skill under pressure, before finally turning northwest and arriving back in Batavia on June 15, 1643.
10 months at sea, two massive land masses charted, and the geographical reality that Australia was separated from other continents was established. A monumental achievement.
Undeniable.
So what was the reaction from the directors of the VOC?
Well, the internal reaction was cold, hard, and brutal. They were disappointed.
Disappointed? After all that?
Yes. From the perspective of the Dutch East India Company, which existed solely to maximize profit, Tasman's explorations were a commercial failure.
It's incredible how quickly corporate objectives just override actual discovery. He hadn't found the gold.
He hadn't found the mythical provinces of beach, which was the main financial driver. He hadn't established a single promising trade area, nor had he found a useful new shipping route.
So the company directors were deeply dissatisfied.
They were. They were not interested in cartography for its own sake. They actually viewed his careful skirting of coastlines as timid. They were upset that he hadn't fully explored the lands to see if they held any commercial value.
And this cold, hard business verdict had immediate and severe consequences for global history.
It did. The VOC decided that a more persistent explorer should be chosen for any future expeditions, and they effectively halted their interest in the Southern Pacific.
So for over a century, until the arrival of James Cook in 1769, Tasmania and New Zealand were just left alone.
Largely unvisited by Europeans, Tasman had put them on the map, but the VOC's disappointment meant they were immediately erased from the map of commercial interest.
He did lead one final major mission.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
For the VOC, though, a smaller one in 1644.
Yes, trying to redeem himself. He commanded a small fleet of three ships, Limon, Zemu, and the Tender Break. The goal was to find a passage to the eastern side of New Holland, or Australia.
But this voyage only reinforced his commercial failure.
It did. The VOC Council had specifically ordered him to explore the possibility of a channel between New Guinea and Australia, what we now call the Torres Strait.
A crucial potential shortcut.
Absolutely. But he missed it. The sources suggest it was likely due to the sheer number of islands and submerged reefs in that area. It would have been incredibly difficult and dangerous in a time before accurate depth charts.
So instead of finding the channel, he sailed south.
And meticulously mapped the Gulf of Carpentaria and much of the North Australian coast before returning to Batavia. Cartographically useful, yes, but he only confirmed to the VOC that the northern coast of Australia was economically barren and didn't offer the shortcut they wanted.
So the company was done with him as an explorer.
They were done funding deep southern exploration, yes. But his administrative career with the VOC continued at a high level.
He was appointed a member of the Council of Justice in Batavia, a powerful post. And he even led a high-stakes military expedition in 1648 to try and loot Spanish silver ships.
Which was unsuccessful. But this is where we confront a darker reality of VOC authority and the rough justice of the era. Despite his high rank, Tasman wasn't untouchable.
In November 1649, he was charged, found guilty, and suspended from his office.
And the offense? For having hanged one of his own men without a trial the previous year during that silver expedition. He was fined and had to pay compensation to the dead sailor's family.
The fact that a senior VOC official was penalized for what was essentially an extrajudicial killing is stark.
It is. It raises the question of whether this was truly about justice, or was it an internal corporate punishment? A way to show that commanders weren't entirely above the company's laws, especially concerning crew discipline.
A warning shot, maybe.
A warning shot, exactly.
Yeah.
He was formally reinstated in 1651, however, and spent his remaining years in Batavia in good standing.
And he died a wealthy man.
He did. On October 10th, 1659, he'd retired 6 years earlier as a wealthy landowner, one of the larger property holders in Batavia. His will even included a 25-guilder bequest to the poor of his birth village, a remarkable end to a career of triumph, failure, and scandal.
Okay, so while the VOC wrote him off as a flop, that 10-month voyage fundamentally redefined the world map. His most significant legacy was proving that the continent he circumnavigated was not joined to that colossal southern continent fantasy.
By establishing the outline of Australia and the separation of Tasmania and New Zealand from that fantasy, he defined Australia as an island continent. even if it took mapmakers another century to accept it.
So let's turn to the landmass that ultimately bore his name. His initial title, Van Diemen's Land, lasted for over 200 years. It was officially renamed Tasmania on January 1st, 1856.
And that name change was a profoundly political and social act.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was in Tasman's honor, but the primary reason was to deliberately differentiate the colony of free settlers from its notoriously brutal convict past.
It was a rebranding exercise.
A complete rebranding to get away from the stench of the penal settlement.
And we have to acknowledge the original identity of the land. The indigenous name is Lutruwita.
Yes, from the Bruny Island Tasmanian language.
Mm-hmm.
And in recent decades, the state government has formally accepted dual naming of important features, like Kunani Mount Wellington, acknowledging that deep history.
And that history the colonists were trying to escape is, well, it's harrowing. European settlement began in 1803 as a strategic penal settlement.
Established largely to preempt any territorial claims by the French, who were also sniffing around the area. The scale of forced migration was staggering. About 80,000 convicts were transported to Van Diemen's Land before it all starved in 1853.
And this led to some of the most feared and notorious penal colonies in the British Empire.
The sources highlight the sheer brutality, particularly at Port Arthur, which became synonymous with cruel isolation, and Macquarie Harbor on the rugged West Coast.
Where conditions were so severe, they were considered a punishment worse than death. The environment itself was used as a weapon of incarceration.
And this rapid, violent colonization led directly to what's known as the Black War, an explosive period of conflict between the settlers and the Aboriginal people, the Palawa or Pakana.
At the time of European contact, their population was estimated to be between 3,000 and 10,000.
And the sources cite multiple devastating drivers for the violence. First, there was increasing competition for resources. Settlers were rapidly turning kangaroo hunting grounds, a staple food for the Aboriginal population, into farms for sheep and cattle.
But there was also a profoundly destructive social element, the severe gender imbalance among the colonists.
Yes, men significantly outnumbered women, often by 4 to 1 or more. This created a crisis of its own. It led directly to what historian Nicholas Clements called a voracious appetite among settlers for native women.
Which triggered immense violence as settlers abducted, raped, and enslaved women and girls.
And that, naturally, provoked fierce and organized reprisal attacks from Aboriginal men. The conflict was not just about land. It was deeply personal, economic, and sexualized.
The violence peaked between 1825 and 1831. The governor, Sir George Arthur, reacting to colonial panic, issued notices that basically permitted colonists to shoot Aboriginal people when their property was attacked.
Then in 1828, he issued a proclamation of demarcation, essentially forbidding Aboriginal people from entering the settled districts. It divided the island into white and black zones.
And his policies became increasingly militaristic. He declared martial law in November 1828, and it stayed in force for over 3 years.
The longest sustained period of martial law in Australian history.
And to enforce this, he organized a massive operation in 1830 known as the Black Line.
The goal was logistically immense. He ordered nearly every able-bodied male colonist plus military regiments to form a single line, miles long, and literally sweep the remaining Aboriginal people out of the settled districts and contain them on the narrow Tasman Peninsula.
But the operation itself was largely a failure.
A logistical failure, yes. The Aboriginal people, who knew the dense terrain, simply melted away. Only a handful were actually captured.
However, by that point, the population had already fallen drastically due to disease, violence, and starvation. After the hostilities ended in 1832, almost all the remnants of the indigenous population were persuaded or forced to move to Flinders Island in Bass Strait.
And that move proved catastrophic. Lacking resistance to introduced diseases, many quickly died from things like pneumonia and influenza. The subsequent removal and near destruction of the population is an event still fiercely debated by historians today.
Right. The sources note that some historians classify the events as an act of genocide, focusing on the policy of complete removal.
While other scholars argue that the colonial authorities didn't have an explicit, systematic intent to destroy the population, highlighting that the removals occurred during a period of open warfare and were driven more by policy failure than deliberate extinction.
Regardless of the precise classification, the result was a demographic catastrophe.
A catastrophe. The last remaining people, including the Wurundjeri, who was claimed to be the last full-blood Aboriginal person to survive, died by 1876.
Acknowledging that devastating history, let's shift focus to the natural history that defines the island today. Tasmania's enduring legacy is also written in its unique geography and ecology.
And those features are intrinsically linked to its isolation. The geology is distinct from anywhere else in the world. The landscape is largely composed of these massive intrusions of Jurassic dolerite.
That's the rock formed when magma pushes up, but cools slowly deep underground, creating unique columnar joints.
Exactly. It's what you see in the organ pipes of Kunani Mount Wellington, towering over Hobart. That slow cooling process results in incredibly hard, sheer rock faces.
In contrast, the rugged southwest of Tasmania is much older, featuring highly resistant Precambrian quartzites.
Which are responsible for those strikingly sharp, jagged ridges you see on mountains like Federation Peak.
Ecologically, Tasmania is a vital refuge. It's the most forested Australian state, containing the largest remaining areas of temperate rainforest in Australia.
The Tarkine, in the island's far northwest, covers an estimated 3,800 square kilometers. It's critically important for global biodiversity.
And it hosts unique flora, like Australia's only winter deciduous plant.
The Australian beech, or Nothofagus gunnii. It sheds its leaves in winter, and its distinct golden red foliage in autumn is a major tourist draw.
And that isolation is crucial for modern conservation. Tasmania is the last natural stronghold for the Tasmanian devil.
Its isolation has become the key advantage in the fight to save the species from devil facial tumor disease, or DFTD.
A contagious cancer that's killed more than half of all devils on the mainland island.
And the conservation strategy relies heavily on that isolation. It allows researchers to establish disease-free zones and relocate healthy devils to isolated peninsulas or offshore islands, ensuring the species survives.
Now, if we expand our view further, Tasman's name stretches across one of the world's most formidable bodies of water.
We're talking, of course, about the Tasman Sea, or as it's known, the Ditch.
Affectionately and sometimes ruefully by Australians and New Zealanders.
It's a marginal sea of the South Pacific, immense in size, about 2,000 kilometers across.
And its depth is staggering. It plunges to nearly 6,000 meters. It's one of the most dynamic and complex bodies of water for oceanographers.
The dominant feature is the East Australian Current, the most energetic circulation feature in the entire Southwest Pacific.
The current that takes Nemo on his long journey.
That's the one. It flows powerfully south from the Coral Sea, transporting heat and tropical marine life. But what's fascinating is how the current fractures. It splits. One major branch, the Tasman Front, flows east toward New Zealand.
And the other critical branch
is the Tasman Leakage. This part is diverted powerfully west through the Great Australian Bight, carrying warm tropical water all the way toward the Indian Ocean. It's a major component of global ocean circulation.
And environmentally, the sea is situated firmly in the path of the Roaring Forties, just like Tasman found.
Which explains why crossings are always a massive challenge and why it earned the nickname the Ditch.
Crossing it was a huge feat of human ingenuity. The first telegraph cable connecting Australia and New Zealand was laid under the Tasman in 1876.
Imagine the engineering and the risk. And then came the aviators. Moncrief and Hood attempted the first trans-Tasman crossing by plane in 1928 and were never seen again.
Swallowed by the Ditch.
But later that year, Charles Kingsford Smith and Charles Ulm finally made the first successful flight in the Southern Cross. Its formidable, deadly reputation is well-earned.
Let's zoom back in on one final geographical feature. The Tasman Peninsula, now known by its dual name, Turkana-Tasman Peninsula.
And this peninsula is historically significant, precisely because of its extreme geographical isolation. It's connected to the rest of Tasmania by only the narrowest bit of land, the isthmus known as Eagle Hawk Neck.
A choke point that was crucial for the Port Arthur penal settlement.
Absolutely. The neck is only about 100 meters wide, a perfect natural security measure. Guards and dogs were permanently stationed there to prevent escapes.
And today, that harsh geography is protected as Tasman National Park, famous for its dramatic coastline.
Featuring the Southern Hemisphere's highest sea cliffs, sheer dolerite columns rising an astonishing 300 meters above the sea at Cape Pillar.
And the relentless ocean power has created these striking geological features like the tessellated pavement and Tasman's Arch.
It's a place that truly brings the violent nature of the Roaring Forties and the dramatic dolerite geology together.
So Tasman's achievements, though dismissal by the VOC at the time, resulted in a truly sprawling posthumous recognition that spans continents.
It's everywhere in New Zealand, from the Tasman Glacier to the Abel Tasman National Park. And even in California, you can find Tasman Drive in San Jose, reflecting the global reach of early Dutch discovery.
For historians, the most important artifact of his work is the Tasman map.
Also known as the Bonaparte map, as it was once owned by Prince Roland Bonaparte. It was completed after 1644, likely drafted by Visscher or Gilsmans.
And since none of the journals from his second voyage survived, this map is the primary record we have of his exploration of the northern Australian coast.
It visually confirms what the Dutch knew at the time. It shows the Gulf of Carpentaria, the whole north coast, and crucially, it clearly shows the Torres Strait area as unexamined.
A visual record of both his geographical success and his commercial failure.
Exactly.
Now, you would think a figure this important would have a clear visual legacy, but even Tasman's portraits are caught up in historical controversy.
They absolutely are. There's a drawing held by the State Library of New South Wales, which scholars think has the most reliable provenance. There's no strong reason to doubt it's genuine.
But then there's the famous family portrait, a large oil painting acquired by the National Library of Australia, which purported to show Tasman, his wife, and his stepdaughter.
And for decades, it was identified as the only known, confirmed portrait of him. But here's where the story gets really interesting.
This is about historical invention.
It is. Recent analysis has concluded definitively that the sitters are not Tasman and his family. The man is almost certainly a prominent Dutch astronomer of the period.
So where did the story come from?
Research into the acquisition revealed that the provenance, the claim it was passed down through Tasman's widow's relatives, was likely invented by the art dealer who sold it, Rex Nan Kivel.
He just made it up.
Seems so. Auction records show the painting was previously sold merely as a generic portrait of an astronomer. Kivel, a major collector, likely created the backstory to raise the value and significance of his acquisition. A classic case of history being manipulated for fame and profit.
So we have an explorer who defined the boundaries of two nations and an entire sea, yet we can't definitively say what he looks like, and his sponsors wrote him off as an expensive failure.
That is the perfect final synthesis of Abel Tasman's legacy. His voyages were a towering geographical success, revealing two major landmasses and proving Australia was a distinct continent. But because he failed to deliver the gold or the shortcut the VOC demanded, they were a crushing commercial failure.
And that failure had a monumental consequence. It stalled further European exploration for over a century, freezing the global map until Captain Cook's arrival. His lasting impact, though, is undeniable. It's visible everywhere, from the unique isolation used to save the Tasmanian devil to the immense currents of the Pacific.
Which leads us to our final provocative thought for you to consider. Tasman was entirely focused on finding the mythical gold of the provinces of Beach and the colossal, non-existent mass of Terra Australis. Yet the greatest, most enduring legacy of his voyages was proving Australia was an island and defining the ditch.
So if the VOC found his work disappointing because it didn't generate immediate, tangible profit, what unknown, non-monetary successes are modern explorations, whether in space, the deep sea, or even pure academic research, failing to appreciate today because they don't match our narrow, short-term definitions of profit and discovery? Something to consider the next time you look at a map.